This is a great crowd tonight. Thank you all for coming out. I really appreciate it. I'm gonna start off with letting you guys know what's on my mind right now. On my way to work this morning, I seen two people who were reading what's actually they said. Totally, I was sitting in the middle of the train, and on my right, someone was reading Westmore's book, and the other was also reading the book. And I actually got a chance to run over to ask them. Ironically, did you know the author is here? And he'll be at the Harvard Bookstore at 7 o'clock. And both of them said, well, unfortunately, I have prior engagements and whatnot. But my point is that, Wes, the word is out. The word is it really is out. It really is. And I'm truly excited to be here to introduce not only a mentor, but a close friend. As I'm currently in the midst of, as many of us, in concluding this tome, I'm beginning to realize how much I can personally relate to this remarkable story. Particularly from a broad perspective, not getting too detailed, the idea of making choices and perseverance that comes along with that. Tackling challenges, situations in our lives, learning from them, and simply getting better going forward. Nonetheless, after reading this tome, I think Wes once speaks about, he expects us to, the readers, us, to gain from, that we understand this book is about so much more than a story of two boys' lives and their different journeys into manhood. It is providing hope that resources from single mothers and single families, fathers, who are raising families on their own, the teachers / mentors who are working with at-risk youth, the teenagers who know that it is the world outside of the inner city or rural plains that they call home, but don't know how to scale the walls to get into, the nonprofit organizations that are the front lines of fighting for tomorrow's of our nation's children each and every day. Iraq, Afghan, veterans of America, the network of teaching entrepreneurship, and the 100 Black Men of America have partnered between the book tours, and their mission is the sole heart of this book, is the sole heart of this book's definition. Lastly, I think most importantly, understanding that this book is not about the casting sub-revisionist history about the tragic events that led to West's final imprisonment or casting doubts about the sentencing. This book is intended to question why West's fate was sealed long before his judgment and what can be done to avoid future tragedies. This book is intended to spark debate and action amongst all of us. Ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, allow me to introduce my good friend, combat veteran, business leader, Mr. Elevate himself, Wes Moore.
Good evening, everybody, and thank you very much for coming through. It is a real pleasure to be here today and to see so many faces, so many friendly faces, and you know, so many people I've known for so long, and also just to come out to an event like this and see so many people, because you never really know when you come out to these events just how many folks are going to show up. And I've always had this fear before I actually became a real author, which I'm still kind of getting used to now, but before I became an author, that you go to one of these events and it's like your mom and your sisters in the front row, which makes Q&A go very quickly as well. So, but it is. I'm just very, very appreciative for everybody being here. And again, folks coming from so far, folks I've known for so many years. Looking in front, I see my good friend Sean is actually in the book, who's actually from New Jersey, but he's probably the biggest Celtics fan in this room, which is still confuses the world out of me. But whatever. But again, I'm just incredibly thankful. Also, just for the response, I'm just incredibly thankful for the response and just the reaction that this book and this entire process has received. Because the amazing thing about it, and the amazing thing about this story, is for folks who knew me, less than 2 decades ago, to include folks like Sean, who was in my first plebe class, this whole process would seem extremely unlikely for a whole collection of different reasons. But the basic story and the basic idea is my family. I was born down in Maryland, and when I was about 3.5 years old, I watched my father pass away in front of me. And that instance, that moment, that my mother went from, you know, being a proud wife and a proud mother and someone who felt like everything was just going great for the family, and then out of nowhere she instantaneously becomes a widow with 3 children. She didn't deal with that transition very well. And what ended up happening was about 2 years after my father passed away, my family ended up moving up to the Bronx to go live with my grandparents. Now, my grandparents had actually immigrated to this country from, my grandfather's actually Jamaican, my grandmother was actually born in Cuba. They were, you know, they ended up getting married in Jamaica, then moving to the Bronx. And what they did when they moved to the Bronx was they bought a small house in the Bronx. And part of their motivation for buying the small house, my grandfather became a minister, and my grandmother became a public school teacher, but wasn't so much just about the shelter, but it's because they wanted to own a piece of this country that brought them in and showed them so much love. So then my mother then moved myself and my 2 sisters and her, we all moved up to the Bronx to go live in this house with my grandparents. And it was an amazing experience moving back with my grandparents. My mother at that time was actually working 3 different jobs. So my grandparents were actually in charge of much of the, you know, rearing and much of the raising as we were growing up. But there was something that we noticed very early, and there was something that my mother noticed very early as we moved back up. And that was the Bronx neighborhood that she was raised in was very quickly becoming a very different neighborhood. The Bronx neighborhood that she was raised in was one where she felt that people would, you know, the neighbors were looking out for each other, and she told all these stories about how peaceful everything was. And the first time she actually saw fights was actually when she moved from New York to down to Washington, D.C. to go to school, go to college. But the Bronx during the 1980s and during the mid and late 1980s was a very different place than the Bronx that she'd grown up in. The Bronx during the mid and late 1980s, just like many other communities inside the country, was going through a massive transition with the introduction of crack cocaine inside of the neighborhoods. There's actually a statistic that we talk about in the book where last year in New York City, there were a little over 400 murders inside of New York City last year. Back in the late 1980s, there were a little over 2,800 murders inside of New York City. And much of it, and much of the rise in violence, much of the rise in crimes, much of the rise of incarcerations came from little vials and what it was doing to break down the entire infrastructure of neighborhoods and communities. And the Bronx ended up becoming one of the many ground zeros that saw this type of downfall. And so as we moved up to the Bronx, and as we moved up to these neighborhoods, I then found myself going through this process, going through this transition into manhood with all these other things going on around me. And in many ways, I got caught up. So by the time I was 11 years old, I was already on academic and disciplinary probation in school. By the time I was 12 years old, my friends and I were out tagging on a street corner wall, tagging up. My tag used to be KK for Kid Cupid. It's a name I gave myself. And then out of nowhere, just as I finished the second K in the circle going around the K's, you hear the whoop, whoop, the cop siren turn around. So my friend and I look at each other, and we immediately start running. He runs in one direction, I run in the other direction. I was a really smart one because the direction I ran in was the direction of the cops. And within about 3 steps, the cops then grab me, throw handcuffs on me, and throw me in the back of a car. And so I'm sitting there terrified because I know the next place I was going to was probably baby booking, which for, you know, baby booking is essentially where they send juveniles when they send you downtown. And I am scared to death, because I knew if I got sent to baby booking, the next call would be to my mother. And that was the last call that I wanted them to make. And I had my friend who was there, and he had his false bravado and his machismo on, and was almost basically daring the cops to do something to him. And I was begging him to shut up, because I knew his destiny was mine at that point. And the cops turned around and they gave us a stern lecturing, and then they gave us a break that day. And they got out of the car, and they let us out, and they took the handcuffs off us, and they told us to get moving. And I made a vow to myself that day that I would never find myself in a position like that again. I made a vow to myself that day that that was the most vulnerable I'd ever felt, and for the first time, I felt like I was no longer in control of my present or my future, because they were. And I made a vow that I would never do it again. And then a week later, about four blocks away, there we were again, and Kid Cupid was marking up walls in the same Bronx blocks. And then finally my mother decided that something needed to be done. And my mother, as she said multiple times before, she felt like she had lost her husband before and she was not about to lose her son as well. And so my mother had been threatening me with military school ever since I was about 8 years old. And she'd always say, listen, if your grades don't get better, I'm gonna send you military school. And I'd say, okay, all right. And then 9 years old came and she said, no, I'm serious. If you don't get it together, you're going to military school. I said, I know, I'm working on it. And then 10 years old came and 11 years old came. And then finally 12 years old, she said, no, really, you're going to military school. And in fact, you're going next week. And then out of nowhere, we packed up the car and we were on our way to a place called Valley Forge Military Academy in Pennsylvania. And for my plea brother and some of the other folks from Valley Forge here, Valley Forge is a far cry from the Bronx for a whole collection of different ways. And that first couple days, I remember my mother, when she was, you know, she dropped me off and she was like, okay, well, I'll see you later. I was like, bye. I mean, she was not the number one person on the Who West Likes list at that point. And then she decided to drop me off. And I remember that first morning when at 5:30 in the morning, when we get our wake up calls. And so 5:30, and I hadn't seen that side of 5:30 in the morning ever up until that point. And so I don't know where you start hearing. I don't know if y'all know the group, the rock and heavy metal group, Guns N' Roses, and the song they play, Welcome to the Jungle. So I don't know where you start hearing, right? All this heavy metal music, lights are flashing. There's trash cans and sticks that they're using to like hit the trash cans to make noise. And then you hear all these very angry teenagers yelling and screaming at us to get out of our beds. And so we're in bunk beds and there's two people per room. I'm laying on the top bunk and my roommate, a guy from Brooklyn, is laying on the bottom bunk. And he jumps up and he's 12 years old and his legs are like this thin. He's shaking like he had to go to the bathroom or something. And he looks up at me and he's like, you know, Moore, we have to get up. We got to get up. Because they were screaming, come on, get up, get out of your racks. Come on, plebes, get out of your racks. And so I'm thinking to myself, I don't know what a plebe is and I don't know what a rack is. But they keep screaming this, plebes, get out of your racks and get out in the hallway. So he's looking at me, he's telling me we got to get up. And I look over at the clock and I see the clock says 5:30. And I'm like, man, it's 5:30 in the morning. I was like, tell him to get me about 8 o'clock. I should be ready to go by then. And he looks back at me and I don't know if he thought I was either, you know, really brave or really dumb and he wasn't gonna wait to figure out which one it was. And then he decides, he runs out in the hallway. And then I hear, why is there only one person outside of this door? And then you hear the door scream. Boom, you hear the door slam, paint chipping off the door. Then this teenager comes in, I assume about 18 years old, comes in and he starts yelling and screaming. I have my back to him because I'm still in my bed. And I'm covered up and I'm trying to get some sleep and he's being very loud. And he's yelling and screaming and spits hitting the back of my head and he's yelling at profanities at me that I've never even heard before. And finally, I start to turn around and I start to look at him. And he stops his yelling because I think he assumes that this tirade was working. And I look at him, I said, man, if you don't get out of my room. He's 18 and I'm 12. So to my surprise, he smiles and he leaves my room. So I'm thinking to myself, you know, this military school thing ain't bad. I think I'll actually adjust to this. And then next thing you know, the chain of command walks in, our squad leaders, platoon sergeant, platoon leader, they all walk into the room and they pick the mattress up off the top bunk and they turn the mattress over as if I still wasn't laying on the mattress. And then we fall fall 5 feet to the floor and then they escort me out to the hallway to join all the rest of my plea brothers. And that was my first morning at my military school. And needless to say, I didn't like it there very much. I didn't want to be there. And continually tried to show that I didn't want to be there by every time they turned around by trying to run out of the gates and try to get out to the train station. And literally in the first 4 days, I ran away 5 times trying to get to this train station. But it was after that last time that I tried my great escape that I started to understand something and actually had a chance to talk to my mom on the phone, which made a big deal. Because after that last time I tried to run away, I had 5 minutes to make a phone call and they said, call whoever you want. We don't care who it is, but you've got 5 minutes. And I called the only number I knew, which is my mom. And she wasn't expecting to hear from me for 6 weeks because we were in the middle of plebe system. And in plebe system, it's your first time in a military environment where you're not allowed any outside communication with the outside world. No phones, no radios, no television, nothing. It's a time where they want to break you down as individuals to basically build you back up as a team. And so now she wasn't expecting to hear from me for 6 weeks. She's hearing from me in the first 4 days at 1 o'clock in the morning. So she picks up the phone. She's like, is everything okay? I'm like, yeah, everything's fine. I just want to come home. And I'll do better. I'll clean my room. I'll clean your room. I'll do whatever it is that you need me to do. Just allow me to come home. And she stopped me. And she said, too many people have sacrificed in order for you to be there. And too many people are rooting for you to do well in order for you to not at least give it a shot. And she said, your father's looking down and he's proud of you. And he just wants you to try. And at that point, and it didn't happen overnight, but gradually I started to understand the bigger picture. I started to understand that I was part of something bigger than just myself. I started to understand that the only way that my plebe brothers can make it was if I pushed them. And the only way that I can make it was if they are pushing me. I started to understand we are part of something larger. I started to understand what accountability meant and leadership meant. And then I started to turn a corner. And later on, I actually ended up joining, after I finished up from high school, I ended up actually joining the Army and becoming a commissioned officer in the Army, going on to Johns Hopkins University. And it was while at Johns Hopkins that the larger concept to this story, to this book, became clear. Because during my senior year at Johns Hopkins, I just received the Rhodes Scholarship. And the Baltimore Sun, which was my hometown paper, was where I was living at that point, and where I was before, then started writing, wrote an article about here. He was a local kid who just received this Rhodes Scholarship. And at the same time, they were running a whole series on four guys who robbed a jewelry store. Four guys ran into a jewelry store, two of them had guns, and two of them had mallets. The two with guns got everybody on the ground, making sure everyone kept their heads down. And the two with mallets then proceeded to go around the jewelry store and smash jewelry cases and grabbing rings and watches and chains. And after they all got away with about $400,000 worth of jewelry, one of them yelled, "Let's go." And then the four guys sprinted out of the store. One of the people that were on the ground was an off-duty police officer who was moonlighting as a security guard. This off-duty police officer was a 13-year veteran of the Baltimore Police Force. Three times he had been named Police Officer of the Year. He had five children. He had triplets. And the only reason he was even working that second job was because he was trying to make extra money for his family. And so as they ran out of the store and ran into the vehicles, he ran outside of the store to see if he could stop them. And he was hiding next to vehicles to see if he could keep them from getting away. And he didn't realize that one of the vehicles that he was hiding next to was one of the vehicles that they were in. And then a window rolled down. And then a gun went out the window, and there were three shots taken at point-blank range and killed him instantly. And there was a 12-day national manhunt for these four guys. And finally, after 12 days, all four were caught. And one of the guys in particular that they caught was living in the same neighborhood that I was living in. He was around the same age that I was, and his name was also Wes Moore. So here in the Baltimore Sun, you have features on two kids. One Wes Moore was heading off to England on this scholarship, and that Wes Moore ended up getting life in prison without the possibility of parole. Him, his older brother, and two other guys all got life without parole. And the story haunted me. How does that even happen? How does it happen that you have two kids who at similar points in their life were going through their own personal challenges and trying to understand this concept of what it means to grow up into a man and end up in two completely different places? And the story haunts me to the point that a few years after I first learned about the other Wes Moore, I decided to reach out to him because I knew there were questions that I wanted answered that only he could provide the answers to. And so I figured out how to do it, and one day I wrote him a note, just introducing myself and then asking a series of questions. And I wasn't sure if I'd even hear back from him. Quite honestly, I didn't think I would. And then a month later, I get an envelope back from Jessup Correctional Institution from Westmore. And the first thing he wrote inside the letter was, he first thanked me even for reaching out to him in the first place, because he said, when you're in prison, you think the whole world doesn't think you exist anymore. And then he proceeded to answer all those questions that I laid out to him. And that one letter turned into dozens of letters. Those dozens of letters eventually turned into dozens of visits. And that became the baseline for the story of the other Westmore. Now, I say that to say essentially this, and why I think that why this book is I would never want this book to be something where people can pick it up and say, well, that's an interesting story, and then just throw the book off to the side and go about their lives. This book is a larger call to action. This book is a larger call to action because it helps explain to all of us what our potency is. Because had it not been for people who stepped into my life, had it not been for my mother utilizing every single piece of leverage around her, had it not been for her friends, had it not been for people who stepped in and gave me a nice conversation or asked me how I was doing, or people stepping in to help me with homework or whatever the case was, mentors, people stepping into my life, aggressive and creative interventions, then I know what the result could have been. And what the result is that, as I say on the cover of the book, the chilling truth is that his story could have been mine. And the tragedy is that my story could have been his. This book and this story is about much more than simply two kids. This book and this story is about much more than simply Baltimore or one neighborhood or one socioeconomic group. It's about all of us. It's about the choices that we make. It's about the people we have in our lives who are helping us to make those choices. And it's about the ramifications for those choices. I make it very clear in the first pages of the book and throughout the book that the only victims that day were Sergeant Bruce Prothero and his family. And I also make it very clear that the whole idea behind this book is not to examine or cast some revisionist history, as Nasir was saying, on what happened that fateful day. But the point of this is to examine why Wes's fate was sealed long before February 7 of 2000. What was happening in the lives of these two boys that essentially causes this split? And the thing I understand is this, is that fundamentally you have two kids who at similar times in their life who were both searching for help. And one kid got it, and the other kid didn't. And now the world bears witness to either our attention or our apathy. And it's ironic in terms of the way if we can look at individuals or look at communities and we cast them off as just, oh, those are their problems. Those aren't our problems. It's amazing how their problems become our problems very quickly, and how ignored areas end up spreading and becoming anything but silent. The idea behind this book, the idea behind this entire process, is to show us how we all can get involved. It's to show us the ramifications of not getting involved. It's about showing us how much of a difference we can make as long as we're willing to do just a little bit, because our smallest decisions in our life can have big ramifications. And all of us can think about it in our own lives. All of us can think about those small things that happened, the small things we did or the small things we didn't do that made all the difference. So I'm incredibly thankful for the fact that people are understanding the message of this story. I'm incredibly thankful that people are understanding the larger mission to this book. And I'm incredibly thankful that people are taking it upon themselves to make a difference in all the others that we have in our society. So what I'd like to do briefly is just this. I've heard that authors at book signings, they read a part of their book. So I think I'll read a part of my book because I'm an author now. It's a short part of the book. But then what I'd like to do is I actually have a few friends who I'd then like to introduce, and I'll get into that. But basically, they're members of nonprofit organizations, and I just ask a few of them just to stand up and talk a little bit about the work that they do, because again, the part of the book that I'm most excited about is actually, I mean, all this stuff is great, and I think it's very well written, and I hope you all will too. But part of the book that I'm really excited about is actually in the back, and it's the resource guide. And basically, it's where to go to help or it's where to go for help. So if you are a single mother in Memphis, and this story touches you, and you can see a little bit of yourself or a little bit of your family inside of these stories, here are organizations that are in your area that would love to hear from you. Or if you're a philanthropist in LA and you want to be helpful, or if you just have some spare time on your hand, here are organizations that would love to hear from you. So what I'd like to do briefly is just to read a little section of the book, and then I'll introduce a couple of my friends from the nonprofit partners. What I've done with this book is actually I've intertwined some different years. And as I was talking with Wes, I actually spent over 200 hours interviewing Wes, his friends and family, and my friends and family, just to make sure that I was really getting the facts and the feel right for the story. And so one thing I realized pretty soon after I started the process of talking to Wes was that there were certain years that were critical in both of our lives. And that's how I decided to break up the book, was actually by different years and what was happening in different years, and use that as a way of helping to explain the path and the trajectory of the boys. But what I tried to do also was intertwine conversations that Wes and I were having in prison. And the reason I thought that was really important was this, is I never wanted the reader to forget the ramifications, and I never wanted the reader to forget the stakes. I never wanted the reader to forget where our conversations were taking place. That they were taking place in a maximum security facility and what exactly that's like. And again, it's not done to sympathize with Wes, but it's done to show the truth. Because part of my frustration is when people have some kind of bravado or gravitas of what prison life is like. Prison is not a game. Prison is not a joke. And every time you walk into a maximum security facility, you know it. And I wanted the readers to always remember that. So this is actually one of the first breakdowns that we had, where Wes and I are actually talking about the role of our fathers. And you'll see in here that, you know, I told you, I explained the story of what happened to my father. And Wes has met his father 3 times in his life. And Wes's father actually lived around the corner from Wes and just wanted nothing to do with him. And in fact, you'll see one of the anecdotes I tell in the book is the last time Wes actually met his father was when Wes was 14 years old. And Wes went over to his paternal grandmother's house because he has a close relationship with his father's mother, but not with his father. And he went over to his paternal grandmother's house and he saw his father sleeping on the couch. And his brother was with him, Wes's brother was with him, and Wes and told him you should go say hello to him. And Wes went to go wake him up. And after tapping him a few times, his father opened his eyes and looked at Wes and he said, "Who are you?" And Wes talked about what that felt like to him. But this is a story where we're talking about the role of our fathers. And this is a little section called Fathers and Angels, Part 1. Wes stared back at me after I'd asked my question, letting a moment pass and a smirk flicker across his face before responding. I really haven't thought too deeply about his impact on my life because, really, he didn't have one. Wes leaned back in his seat and threw an even stare at me. "Come on, man," I pressed on. You don't think about how things would have been different if he'd been there, if he'd cared enough to be there?" "No, I don't." The lower half of his face was shrouded by the long beard that he'd grown, an outward sign of the Islamic faith he'd adopted in prison. His eyes danced with bemusement. He was not moved by my emotional questioning. "Listen," he went on, "your father wasn't there because he couldn't be. My father wasn't there because he chose not to be. We're going to mourn their absence in different ways." This was one of our first visits. I had driven a half hour from my Baltimore home into the Woody Hills of Central Maryland to Jessup Correctional Institution to see Wes. Immediately upon entering the building, I was sternly questioned by an armed guard and searched to ensure I wasn't bringing anything in that could be passed on to Wes. Once I was cleared, another guard escorted me to a large room that reminded me of a public school cafeteria. This was a secured area where prisoners and their visitors came together. Armed guards systematically paced around the room. Long tables with low metal dividers separating the visitors from the visited were the only furnishings. The prisoners were marched in, dressed in orange or blue jumpsuits or gray sweatsuits with DOC emblazoned across the chests. The uniforms reinforced the myriad other signals around us. The prisoners were owned by the state. Lucky inmates were allowed to sit across from regular tables from their loved ones. They could exchange an initial hug and then talk face to face. The rest had to talk to their families and friends through bulletproof glass using a telephone. Visitor and prisoner connected by receivers, they held tightly to their ears. Just as I was about to ask another question, Wes interrupted me. Let me ask you a question. You come here and ask me all these questions, but you haven't shared any of yourself up with me. So tell me, what impact did your father not being there, having your childhood? I don't know. I was about to say more when I realized I really didn't have more to say. Do you miss him? He asked me. Every day, all the time, I replied softly. I was having trouble finding my voice. It always amazed me how I could love so deeply, so intensely, someone I barely even knew. I was taught to remember, but to never question. Wes was taught to forget, and to never ask why. We learned our lessons well, and we were showing them off to a T. We sat there just a few feet from each other, both silent, pondering an absence. Thank you very much. And as I said, the part of this book that I'm most proud of is actually the part in the back where we have the resource guide. And what I've asked is for a couple folks from a few nonprofit organizations just to stand up and just spend a few minutes, just talk about what they do, why their work is so important. And what I like to do is just, you know, briefly just introduce all three, and then they can all three, you know, in order, just go down the line. The first person is Claire McCulley, who is the ED for the Network for Teaching Entrepreneurship in the New England area. And for those who don't know, the Network for Teaching Entrepreneurship is an organization that works with young people all around the country, and actually all around the world, teaching them entrepreneurship skills, and basically how not just to be employees, but how to be employers, teaching them about business plans, and teaching them how to take a passion and turn it into a business. And it's an organization that has now been around for 25 years, correct? 25 years, and has just been doing amazing work inside of communities. The second is actually one of the partner organizations we have for the book. The second organization is City Year, and Jonathan Hinthorn is going to speak about City Year. City Year, for those who don't know, and actually all y'all should know because it started in Boston, but is an organization that gives young people a year of service and helps young people at a very early age understand that they're part of something bigger than themselves. And they devote a year of themselves to helping out communities all over and just teaching them the basic skills of accountability and service. And you see them around because you see everyone with the red jackets. And you see the red jackets in communities all over the place. And actually, City Year, one of the things also what we're doing is a significant portion of all book proceeds are going to two different organizations. One is the U.S. Dream Academy, which supports children of the incarcerated, and the other is City Year. So with every book that you purchase, y'all are getting a piece. But I want to thank you for being too, Jonathan. And also Ebenezer. Ebenezer is actually from the Jackie Robinson Foundation, who's also a Harvard student. So he didn't have a very long commute today. But very proud. He's a junior now. He's studying chemical and physical biology. Jeez. but he's a Jackie Robinson scholar. And basically what the Jackie Robinson Foundation does is the Jackie Robinson Foundation provides scholarships to minority students to attend schools, institutions of higher education. And Ebenezer, you're just a great example of who Jackie Robinson produces and the type of efforts and the type of work that the Jackie Robinson scholars will do. So what I'd like to do is briefly just turn it over to these three. I'll lean back and I'll let them take over. But thank you so much.
Thank you, Wes. You are a great friend to NIFTY. The Network for Teaching Entrepreneurship, we here in New England work with students in Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Hartford, Connecticut, and Southern New Hampshire. We work in the inner city. What we're trying to do is level the playing field for those students. We're teaching financial literacy, best business practices, just really economic justice. And we're working within the public schools as well as with community-based organizations. I'm proud to say that we're now reaching 1,600 students here in Boston, New Bedford, Lawrence, I mean, you name a hard-hit city, and that's where NIFTY is. As Wes knows, these kids are incredible. They're 17 and 18 years of age. They have amazing ideas. They just need someone to not give them a handout, but a hand up. and that's what our organization tries to do. So a week from Wednesday, we will be having our final business plan competitions. The kids are amazing, and those that go on get an opportunity to be in New York, where Wes has seen what they do. And again, we try to provide them with some scholarship money and some venture capital. We hope that they will continue their education, but if not, we want to send them out into the business world to become employers or to be better employees. So thank you, Wes.
Thank you.
My name is John Hinthorne, and to be honest, I didn't know how amazing this man was or the story that he told until I got here, and I'm really honored to be here. I wrote a couple things. I'm actually going to scrap it because I feel moved to talk about two things that Wes talked about. He talked about intervention in a way that I think City Year does a really nice job. He mentioned that City Year provides a year of service for young, energetic, idealistic people such as who you're looking at. I try to be that. It's not easy in the face of what we're trying to fight sometimes. But he talked about aggressive and creative intervention. And I think that's what we do wearing this red jacket. I've never been more proud to wear something and go to work than I am right now. And I say that completely sincerely because of the work that we do and the results that I think we've had on young children. At first, when I went into the Tobin School in Roxbury, I see a couple of people nodding. It's in Mission Hill and a very vibrant, to say the least, community. And I go into the school from a family of educators. I love teaching peace, and that's hard to do, but I think possible. And I go in as an educator. I taught high school Spanish for 2 years before I did this, and the clock was nearing its end because City Year hires up till 25, and I had just turned 25. So my time was up, and I was ready. I was put on a team. I'm sitting in the Tobin Middle School for the first year, and I'm looking at the students that I'm about to work with. And to be totally honest, I was there was a big part of me that was kind of turning, a kind of a worry. Am I going to be able to do this? Are we going to have any change? And now I'm sitting at the end of my service, 1,700 hours of service. I mean, I probably did 20 hours of service before this year. Always had a heart to do it, but never had the courage to go up and do it. Felt empowered to do it, and 1,700 hours of tireless work, wanting to give up at times, many times. I have stories that I'm going to go on telling my grandchildren, stories not too much unlike yours. I think the story that affected me the most was one with a student named Minray. She's a 15-year-old eighth grader, and Minray has been kicked out of her house twice and been living on the street. Many times we've had to get her food just so that she can subsist, and incredibly intelligent. That usually is the case with these students, is they're so intelligent. They're way beyond where I ever was in middle school, but 15 sitting in eighth grade and a deep sense of emptiness. And every time I went over to her, I'd say, "Hey, Minray, how are you? Good morning." Nothing for an entire month, nothing. I'd even get negative reactions, you know, things I can't say right now in public. And I was at the point where I'm going to give up. And I'm going to help the people that are turning to me and giving me, you know, the whites of their eyes. And I remember I was helping with a student with their writing, and I look, and it's one of those stories like yours, and I'm helping him, and all of a sudden I hear this, "Mr. Hinthorne," and I turn around, and there's Minray, and she's looking at me, giving me that whites of her eyes, and she's asking me to come over and read what she had written, and I nearly fell over. What is this? And that the tools that we all have, I think, of love and that innate sense of peace that I think sometimes gets sheltered over, we all have. And so my call to action, and I think City Year's call to action and this book's call to action is one and the same. I think whether you're 18 to 25 or 18 to 85 or 90, we all have the capability and the know-how, and we should be finding these organizations. So I applaud this book, and I applaud the other 1,400 people wearing the same jacket, doing the same thing in 20 different sites around the world. It's an amazing time to be alive, and I think being an idealist, I think we're gonna beat this. So thank you.
Thank you. First off, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak today, and I'm very grateful for that. I'm proud to be a representative of the Jackie Robinson Foundation today and be a witness to the good work in which they have produced. Back in 1973, Mrs. Rachel Robinson had a dream to uphold the values of her late husband, the great baseball legend and civil rights activist Jackie Robinson. She remembered his words that a life is not important except in the impact it has on others' lives, and put them into action by creating the Jackie Robinson Foundation Scholarship for underserved minority students who have the ability to attend college, only do not have the financial means to attend. And now today, the Jackie Robinson Foundation has awarded over $40 million in scholarships to over 1,400 students. My education at Harvard University as a rising senior is a direct result of the generosity and the vision of Mrs. Rachel Robinson and all those who have worked for the foundation. But JRF is so much more than a check in the mail. It is in many ways a family, my family. Families guide each other. The Jackie Robinson Foundation offers exclusive internships and career development opportunities for us as students. Families relate with one another. By hosting a 5-day, all-expense-paid networking weekend annually in New York City, I was able to become close friends with many of my JRF scholars while we learned to become young professionals together. And lastly, families help each other. During each of these networking weekends each year, we have a family session where we tell each other our successes and our failures, our proud and pitiful moments. And let me tell you, I feel the love in the community in these sessions. Speaking of community, JRF also teaches us to give back by having the scholars serve the community by a community service event each year, whether it is cleaning up a park or tutoring young students. I, in fact, took this same level of service that they taught us and established another program at Harvard to help students in Dorchester who are in need. It's the John Marshall Elementary School tutoring program, helping kids in an underserved population ages 8 to 11. With the community-driven mindset in JRF, it's no wonder that the Jackie Robinson Foundation boasts a college graduation rate of 97%, which is over twice the national rate of minority students. I know the author Wes Moore, growing up in an impoverished neighborhood like myself, had a community that he relied on as well in his formative years. And I know that when I plan to enter medical school next year, the Jackie Robinson Foundation, through their generous extra innings program for graduate students and their careful guidance, will help me every step of the way. My name is Ebenezer Asari. I'm a proud member of the Jackie Robinson Foundation.
Thank you all very much. Thank you. Thank you again, Nasir. And what I'd love to do now is open it up to any questions that the folks might have. For anyone here, the question was about Wes's mother. And I make it known to anyone who will listen to me how blessed and thankful I am for the mother that I had. But also I make it very clear that this is not a compare and contrast of two moms, because it's much deeper than that. Because the fact is, in this story, you have two moms who both care deeply for their children. You had two moms that both were working multiple jobs at the same time. I was fortunate in that when my mother was when my mother then moved up to the Bronx, we were able to move up with my grandparents, who then helped, with that process, and were able, as my mother, and I talk about it in the book, where my mother would wake us up in the morning, and then have to head off to work before we were even ready for school, and by the time she came back in from her last job, we were already asleep. Wes's mom had a very similar circumstance, except didn't have that same kind of leverage. And the truth is about Wes's mom is Wes's mother was the first one in her family to go to college. Wes's mother went to graduated from Baltimore City Community College and then was accepted to Johns Hopkins University. And then in the early 1980s, the Pell Grants were cut and she could no longer afford to go. So I can't help but think how life would have been different for her and then different for her children had she been able to finish school, as one example. So one thing I don't want is for people to look and say, okay, here it's bad mom, good mom, bad son, good son. And I wasn't saying that you were saying that. But the context behind Wes's mom is important to understand, because it's not like you had a mother who didn't care. You had a mother who was overwhelmed. And you had a mother who felt herself fighting against a neighborhood that in many ways was fighting against her. And then we start seeing the rollback results. But thank you. And I've actually got a chance to know, Wes's mom actually pretty early in the process. I'm still very in close touch with Wes's mother. And also now the fact that Wes's mother is now raising Wes's children. She's raising two of Tony's children, his older brother. And also she's got her own son now who's 15 years old. And Wes is now also a grandfather. Wes became a grandfather at 33. So his mother still is feeling a significant, you know, burden with all this as well. Thank you very much. The question was about concern about the guns in the community. Now we have, they're actually, you know, they're jurisdictions that actually have gun buyback programs. I know New York has a very aggressive one. Baltimore had one for a short period of time where basically they would buy back individual guns. But I don't think we can overstate the need to get guns, particularly illegal guns, out of the hands of people. Because in there are communities in this country that it is easier to find a gun than it is to find a job. And that is a fundamental problem that we've got inside of this community. So I know that there's Mayor Bloomberg and Mayor Booker and a few other mayors, Mayor Diaz of Miami, have actually started a coalition called basically asking for, I'm not sure the exact name, but asking where mayors are getting involved in basically curtailing the illegal guns that are in so many communities and that are just so readily available in so many communities. But it is a significant problem, because even if you look at the guns that were used inside of the final killing of Sergeant Prothero and the vehicles that were used inside of the killing of Sergeant Prothero, these were guns that were gotten, that they were able to buy and purchase very easily. Very easily. So it's a significant problem. And to answer specifically, I don't know if there are any specific organizations in the back of this book that deal with that, but I know there are organizations. And in fact, if you want to remain in touch, the website for the book is www.theotherwesmore.com, and there's a spot to contact me. And I really do contact people. We can actually stay in touch on that, and I can find that information out, because I know it's an issue that I actually care deeply about, is making sure we can get guns, particularly legal guns, out of the hands of folks who don't need them. The ice grill. You had that part, huh? There's a part in the book where I talk about what the ice grill is. And the ice grill, and I can't remember what page it's on, but I said it's 28. Page 28. why don't I read real quick, because I really like that part. Thank you so much. Okay. There's a term in the hood for a face like Tony's. By the way, Tony is Wes's older brother in this. And you'll see Tony was a different kind of guy. Tony had left school by the time he was in eighth grade. Tony had been involved in the drug trade in Baltimore before his age even hit double digits. And Tony is fascinating, because Tony spent much of his childhood trying to keep Wes out of the drug game, a game that Tony got involved in very early on in life. And that's actually a relatively common thing, where you find older guys who are involved who are trying to keep their younger brothers out because they understand the stakes. And as he said to Wes, you're not built for this. But Wes, in an attempt to be just like his older brother, found it very difficult to stay out. But it says, there's a term in the hood for a face like Tony's, that cold, frozen stare, the ice grill. It's a great phrase. The look of blank hostility that masks two intense feelings, the fire evoked by grill, which is slang for face, and the cold of the ice. But the tough facade is just a way to hide a deeper pain or depression that kids don't know how to deal with. The bottomless chasm of insecurity and self-doubt that gnaws at them. Young boys are more likely to believe in themselves if they know that there's someone, somewhere, who shares that belief. To carry that burden of belief alone is too much for most young shoulders to bear. Tony had been overwhelmed by that load years ago. Now he wanted to help Wes manage his. Like a soldier after years of combat, Tony hated the war and wanted Wes to do whatever he could to avoid it. He was willing to risk seeming like a hypocrite if necessary. And so basically what that is that when you see people who will kind of have that stare, that look, that, you know, that blank the world look on their face, that is essentially the ice grill. And essentially what I'm also trying to say about the term of the ice grill is that in many cases, it's just trying to mask something much deeper, a much deeper pain, a much deeper fear, a much deeper depression that hasn't been dealt with. And it's the same type of anger that I know I felt when I got sent away. It's the same kind of fear that I felt when I got sent away. And it's the same ice grill that I gave my mom and anyone who's willing to look at me those first few days in military school, because it almost becomes your mask. There's a poem by Baldwin when it's called "We Wear the Mask," and it starts, "We wear the mask that grins and lies. We wear the mask that grins and lies. It hides our teeth and it shades our eyes." And that's that ice grill. That's that mask that you see so many people wearing because they're trying to hide something deeper. Well, you know, it's interesting because I think this process has really helped me. There's a couple things I think I've personally got a clear idea about through this process. One is this concept of nature versus nurture, and the other is this concept of fate and what that means. In terms of the nature versus nurture argument, I think it is impossible and it's naive to completely disregard nature in things. Where we come from, our families, our DNA, that does help in terms of determining where we're going to go. In fact, there's a phrase that Cornel West used inside the book, and I highlight where he says, our roots help determine our routes, which I think is a good point, or routes for some. But I think that also if we just put so much of the focus on nature and we de-emphasize the nurture part, it's almost letting us off the hook. And we can't help, we can't shape the nature. The nature has been written. The nature is done. The things we can affect are the nurture. And there's something also I know about Wes. Wes is not a dumb guy by any stretch of the imagination. That was one of the things that most amazed me by that first letter that he wrote me, was actually how articulate that letter was. And that's the most frustrating thing about it, is because it had those interventions been in place, I can't help but think what type of contribution he could be making to society. But the decisions that he made have now placed him where he is, and he'll be there until he's taken off this planet. And that's the thing that's most frustrating, is that opportunity cost. It's the underutilized assets that we see in so many communities. And not just the Dorchesters, or not just the South Bronx, or not just the West Baltimores, but in all communities. And that's really what I wanted to emphasize. And the second part, this whole idea of fate. I firmly now believe that there is no such thing as predestined fate, where people are born to be X or people are born to be Y. I think that potential in this country is universal, but opportunity is not. And that space in between potential and that space in between reality is where we all come in. And that's where we can help actually shape those fates. The question was about the White House Fellowship and the impact that it had on my career. You know what? It's interesting. I think the this might not be the answer that you might be looking for, but here's the thing that the White House Fellowship taught me, quite honestly. First of all, the best thing about the White House Fellowship for me were the people that I met there, the other White House Fellows, because they are just an extraordinary group of Americans who are doing great things. I spent 2005 and 2006 in Afghanistan, on the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan with the 82nd Airborne Division. I'm a paratrooper. And so I got a chance to see how policy is actually practiced during that year. And then I came back to work at the State Department and as a White House Fellow. And I got a chance to see how policy was made. And one of the big takeaways I got from that is that there was an extraordinary disconnect. And it's not just an extraordinary disconnect on how we look at foreign policy, but how we look at domestic policy as well. Is sometimes the laws that we put into place don't actually touch the people that they're supposed to affect, because there is that massive disconnect. So if you're asking about the lessons that I learned from the White House Fellowship, it was an extraordinary experience, because you get a chance to work as a senior level advisor to a cabinet level secretary, and you travel the country and travel the world representing the White House. But it also helped me to understand the limitations of Washington. And one thing I also believe is that sometimes when we look at policymakers, and again, I have a tremendous amount of respect for many policymakers. But I know this. We do ourselves a disservice when we put too much of reliance on what they can do for us. Because the power and the potency is with us. The power and the potency is, you know, they control budgets. They have an extraordinary amount of power. And the ones who practice it correctly can do extraordinary good. But it's not on them. And that's one of the things I helped realize during my year in the White House Fellowship is how important Washington is, and how potent Washington is, and how impotent it can be when it comes to really solving certain problems. And that's where we come in. Thank you. The question was about image, and particularly images and realities, particularly for African-American boys. There's actually a scene in the book where Wes and I are talking. And again, we're talking in prison. And I asked him a question. I said, do you think that we're products of our environments? And he said, I actually think we're products of our expectations. And I thought that was really interesting because he said, and I asked him to clarify, and he basically said, well, if people expect you to graduate from high school, graduate from college, be a good father, be a good husband, be an upstanding member of society, then that's probably what you'll do. Because it's amazing how kids will actually rise to meet our expectations that we place on them. But if the expectations that we place, not just on individuals, but on entire communities at times, as they probably won't finish, they probably won't graduate, they probably will end up in the criminal justice system, they probably will be in and out of facilities their entire life, then it's amazing how kids will probably do that too. And I think it's a very important point to think about how we actually think about expectations, because also the expectations that we receive externally are the expectations that we put on ourselves internally. There came a point in my life that, more than just my mom, because that's what it seemed like at times, but there were other people who said, you know what, Wes can actually do some good stuff. We actually see Wes as being able to actually make a contribution, to one day be, you know, I talk about the process where I first learned about the Rhodes Scholarship, where it was Mayor Schmoke, who was a former mayor of Baltimore, who I was interning with, who pulled me into his office, and he said, you know what, Wes, I want you to apply for this Rhodes Scholarship. I think you can actually get it. I think you're going to be very competitive. His expectation of me was that I was going to be a Rhodes Scholar. Therefore, my expectation was that I'm going to be a Rhodes Scholar. He changed my entire perspective in one conversation. And that's when I think when we talk about images and who we are and what we are, so many times we have to be careful of the images that we'll place on people because they will internalize them, whether we realize it or not. And that becomes the images and the expectations that they eventually place upon themselves. So I think that's a major issue and something really has to be addressed because the elevation of communities and the elevation of young people is not about picking them up from one community and putting them into another community. It's not about, you know, telling me how bad this is or bad that is. It's about a psychological process. It's a psychological evolution, and a lot of that is going to be determined by image because image becomes reality. So thank you. The question was about Riverdale Country School, and in the story I talk about, my mother decided pretty early when we moved back to the Bronx that the Bronx schools were not going to be where I was going to go. In fact, during my fourth grade year, a year that she was actually considering sending me back to, which was our neighborhood school, kind of the Evander Childs, because these schools were very expensive, that was literally the year that a girl got shot in the face at school. And my mother was like, okay, that's not where you're going to school. I quickly found myself too rich for the kids in my neighborhood who didn't understand why I had to go to school across town and couldn't go to school back in the neighborhood, and too poor for the kids in school because they didn't understand my neighborhood back at home. And so what you do is you find yourself kind of straddling these two worlds, trying to find your feet and realizing you're not comfortable anywhere and you weren't yourself anywhere. And then you're confused as to what yourself even was. And so part of the challenge for me was I didn't appreciate that kind of environment because I still consistently found myself trying to fit in. And that's one thing I firmly believe about kids. You know, all kids are looking for is a chance to fit in. They're looking for a chance at acceptance. They're looking for who is going to be that group that's going to take me in, that's going to make me feel comfortable, that's going to have, so I don't have to have any airs and I can just be myself. And what was happening with me as I was going off to this school, because I felt at that time I didn't have that level of comfort there, is I would do whatever people told me to do. Whether it be kids in neighborhood saying you want to tag, or whether it be kids in school, I was skipping school, whether it be putting smoke bombs inside of lockers that got Sean's uncle, who's head of the fire department, called in because they thought it was a big fire at school. I mean, I would do whatever I was told to do, whatever people wanted me to do, so long as I felt like I was being accepted. And then it's amazing when you get in trouble, you're looking around for your friends and they're nowhere to be found. They're pointing at you like, man, I can't believe he did that. And so that was, I think, part of the real transition that I had to go through, and part of the reason why, despite being a great place, I just increasingly became very lost in that place, and why eventually the decision was, you know, we're gonna have to try something new. We're gonna have to try something even after that. Thank you. And in fact, there were two things that really pushed me to write this book, because initially I was actually approached by a friend of mine who's a writer, and she knew that I'd reached out to Wes, and I'd known Wes for a while then, and she said, you know, I think this is a book. I think this is a larger story. And I said, I don't. And there was a couple reasons. I didn't feel like I had time. I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to look that deeply into his life. And I really didn't want to look that deeply into my own life. And there were two real things that kind of pushed me to want to do this. And it's coming back to your question. the first thing was I thought about the police officer's death and his family, and the fact that if I could do something that could hopefully keep these terrible tragedies from happening again, then I needed to do it. And as Edmund Burke once said, he's like, all it takes for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing. And I thought about something that Wes said, because I talked to Wes about it. And Wes said, you know, listen, I've wasted every opportunity I've ever had in life, and I'm gonna die in here. And if you can do something that can help people understand their decisions, the ramifications for their decisions, and also help people understand the neighborhoods that these decisions are being made in, then I think you should do it. So I think Wes recognizes there were a lot of points where different decisions could have been made, but I think there's something about education, and here's why education is so important to me. Education is not just important because of reading and writing and arithmetic. Education is important because it also teaches you things like critical thinking. Education teaches you things like consequences. And there are scenes in this book where it's literally heartbreaking reading it, because you're looking at when he's at one of these crucial junctures, and you're like, come on, come on, come on. And he goes this way, you're like, you've got to be kidding me. And it happens again and again and again, and it happens to the point that eventually it becomes too much, and it's too much to turn back. There's actually a scene in the book, and probably one of the most powerful scenes for me when I was doing this research, was Wes was talking about the Job Corps. And I don't know if many people are here familiar with the Job Corps, but it was created during the Great Society. And basically what it is, you go there, you spend, I believe it's 8 months there, and you go for GED training, you go for job training, and then they put you back out. And generally these are people who have been involved in the juvenile justice system or the criminal justice system. Wes does the Job Corps. And Wes finishes the Job Corps. He completes his GED faster than anyone else in his group. He, at that point, was reading at a sophomore in college reading level. Got his GED, goes in Job Corps, learns a skill, learns how to do carpentry. And he comes out from his skills of being a carpenter, and he can only find odd jobs because he can't find anyone who can hire him. He has a criminal record, he's got 4 children, he's making about $6.50, $7 an hour. He's got 2 babies' mom that are calling him, say they need more money. His mom is helping to raise the children, she needs more money. And after a few months on the outside, Wes goes back to what he knew best. And he goes back to the corners. And so this idea of choices and personal responsibility, you're absolutely right that it isn't also just about kind of societal, but it's personal choices as well. And there are key points in the book for both boys where you see some good decisions were made and some bad decisions were made, and you see how those ramifications for those decisions end up playing themselves out to a point where, you know, you're rooting for both, and then you just realize it's not going to happen. So you see that throughout. And thank you, because that is very important, because I think there's a tremendous amount of discretion that police officers can take in that. But also, I think we also have to remember, you know, their job and well is also how difficult, you know, their job is in that as well. But at the same time, even going back to that point, one of the things I think we see within the book is how much these choices are just there, they, you know, cross-pollinate anything about race or socioeconomic dynamics. Again, we think about them in our own lives and the decisions that we make, the things that we did when we were teenagers, the things that we did a week ago that could have had drastically different results had a different decision been made. And I think all this tries to do is just try to highlight how those decisions play themselves out. So.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you.